Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Mike Burns. Can y'all hear me?
Yep.
Good. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Gary, for opening the meeting. And, you know, they say AA as such ought never be organized. But it is, it's so good to be here. It's good to be here with y'all. I'd like to thank Billy for inviting me to do this. And my sobriety date is September the 17th of 1992. And I'm a member of the New Life Big Book Study Group in Mount Airy, North Carolina, which is right below Fancy Gap. And me and my wife just moved up here right above Fancy Gap last year in August and got settled in before all the craziness started around the country. And so, but I am grateful to be here. And I do have a sponsor. His name's Bob. He lives down in Greenville, South Carolina. And I sponsor guys, man. I'm going to tell you, it's, this pandemic, you know, I've spoke at meetings where they ask questions, and it seemed like every time they would ask, how do you sponsor in this time, you know? Well, the phone works real good for me, but also I'm in an area where, I mean, there's a lot of wide open space up here, and I've been able to have sponsees come up and stay, you know, distanced or whatever, and to get in the book with those guys, man. And I'm gonna tell you, that's one thing that I don't know what it would be like if I couldn't do that, man, because I've always done that, you know. And but I am grateful to have some guys up here now that really want this thing, or they act like they do anyway. But I was born in Charlotte, North Carolina. I was born into a good family. My dad left my mama when she was pregnant with me, and my mama had three kids, and I was on the way, and my dad left, and he never gave her a dime with four kids, you know. My grandparents took us in their home, and I grew up in a good home, man, good Christian home. They, my grandparents were real active in a church, and they made sure the kids went to church, and, you know, I kind of feel like maybe if when I was a kid, when I went into that church, if they would have appointed me a sponsor to kind of tell me what we were trying to do here, maybe my life would have turned out a little different, but they didn't, you know. I'm kind of grateful they didn't, because I might not be here if that would have happened. But, so, you know, I mean, they taught us everything they were supposed to teach us, right from wrong, good from bad, respect people, you know, treat people like you'd want to be treated. You know, they taught me about being responsible and all the things that parents teach their kids. And, you know, as far back as I can remember, I was a scared little kid, man. If you weren't in my family, I was afraid of you, you know. Even going to that church growing up as a kid, you know, I was afraid of those people. Going to school, I hated going to school and being around all them kids, you know. And I got drunk the first time when I was 12 years old. And when I got drunk the first night, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but I guarantee you the first time I got drunk, an alcoholic was born. I knew I was going to drink that stuff every chance I got, and I did. I grew up in an area where it was easy to get something to drink, and I grew up by some railroad tracks, you know, and we'd walk the railroad tracks to school in the morning, 12, 13 years old, and we'd pitch our lunch money in and get them winos to get us something to drink, and hey, we'd go out, you know, we'd start drinking that Boone's Farm, that Wild Irish Rose, that Mad Dog, Orange Jubilee, all that good stuff on the way to school in the morning. A lot of times we'd overshoot the mark and just wouldn't go to school, you know. And so I never did get no education. I hated going to school, and I missed a lot. But, you know, by the time I was 15, I was a blackout everyday drinker, you know. And I was a blackout drinker from day one. And I'd start drinking, and I'd come to in places I never dreamed I'd come to. I went to a New Year's Eve party in Charlotte, North Carolina, 15 years old. I came to in Daytona Beach, Florida, you know, and I don't know how I got there. I stayed on the streets of Florida for 3 weeks, never called home, you know. My mom was scared to death I was dead somewhere, but stayed on the streets for 3 weeks in Florida, ended up getting arrested my first time in Lakeland, Florida. And they put me in a little juvenile prison for 3 days, and they sent me back to Charlotte, North Carolina on probation. Got back, my mama said, "You need to turn yourself in," and I said, "For what?" And me and a buddy of mine robbed a little old lady in the neighborhood park, you know, and I don't remember doing that. And so that should have told me early on, you ought not drink. You get in bad trouble. But see, I didn't care about the consequences of my drinking because of what alcohol did for me. I found out when I drank alcohol and felt the effects, I could go places I normally couldn't go. I could be around people I normally can't be around, and I can do things I normally can't do, you know. So why wouldn't you drink? And I drank, you know, every day for a long time. And only days I didn't drink is when I was laid up in a hospital bed or in a jail cell, you know. But I was in and out of jail, so I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated going to school. I made D's and F's through junior high school, and they passed me every year. I remember they sent me to the 10th grade, and the 10th grade, the only thing I remember about the 10th grade is it was the funnest 3 years of my life, you know. I'd show up, and we'd go out in the woods and drink, and so I knew I wasn't going to get an education. My mama said, if you ain't going to school, you need to go to work. So I quit school, went to work doing carpenter work, and found out they drank on the job. You know, I kind of like that, you know. Every job I ever had, I found one I could drink on. And so I've done all kind of different construction work and carpenter work. And I remember when I was 21 years old, I got my driver's license for the first time. And I didn't like, you know, whenever I didn't feel comfortable living somewhere, I'd move on. And I was back at my mama's house at 21 years old, and I didn't like living by her rules. So they gave me this big, long van to work out of installing cable TV for a contracting company in Charlotte. And I felt comfortable in that van, so I packed my clothes up and moved in that van, you know. I'd park out on dead-end roads, and I'd pull up in down on this creek bank in some woods where I grew up at, where all the drunks hung out by the creek bank, you know. And but I was down there one night drinking, and a bunch of guys came down. There was one girl with them. She didn't like where she was living, so I let her move in with me, you know. And so we'd go. I'd drop her off in the morning at her dad's house, and she'd make me a sandwich. I'd go to work and pick her up in the evening. We'd go out drinking, you know. And I'd always come to at daybreak and make it to work on time. Well, my best friend was 23 years old, and his daddy wouldn't let him in his house, but he let him sleep out in the backyard in a 56 Chevrolet station wagon. It sat on blocks, and he put a tarp over it where you couldn't see in or out of it. And him and his girlfriend lived out there for 3 years in that car. His daddy did let him have a drop cord to hook power up out there. So he got him one of them strip plugs where you can hook six different appliances up to it. Had a little heater for the winter, a fan for the summer, a little color TV and stereo out there in that car. And doing the work I did, I hooked his HBO and Cinemax up for him, you know. Good fight, come on HBO, me and my girl riding around drinking, we'd go to their house, you know. And climb in that car, and I don't know about y'all, two couples drinking in tight quarters like that stuff will happen. We'd roll out the backyard fighting, and finally his daddy got tired of it and run us all off, you know. Being a good friend I was, I let them move in with us in a Cablevision van. Now we got two couples, you know. And things started going downhill after they moved in. And it wasn't long after they moved in, you know. We used to hang out down on the Catawba River at a place called Hubie's Bubble Up. And we slept out there a lot of nights out there in that van. But I remember there was an old trailer park out there, and a lot of the guys I worked with lived out there. And we was out there one night, and one of them said, my boy ain't never been to a bar. I said, well, I'll take him, you know. And I took his son to Charlotte, got him a 12-pack of Bud, and I got me a fifth of George Dickel White Label. And I'm chasing my liquor with his beer, and we're hitting all these pool rooms, you know, having a good time. And I remember we were riding down the road, and I told that boy to grab the steering wheel so I could take me a drink, and he did. And I got pulled over by the cops, and I remember the cops come up to my window, and I looked at him. I said, was I speeding? He said, no, you crossed that center line back there. I just leaned back and said, you want to talk to this boy over here? He was steering, you know. He didn't like that too good. He drugged me out by the hair of the head and locked me up, impounded our home, you know. And by this time, I'd been arrested in Charlotte so much for public drunk, I had a bondsman named Blue that would get me out of jail on credit and meet me at the bank on Fridays. And he come got me out, and I walked the streets. They told me where the van was going to be, and I went down the next day and begged and pleaded with them, and they finally gave it to me, and I went to work, you know. The very next weekend, I got another DWI down in Lincoln, North Carolina. And same thing, I got out on bond, you know, and then about a month after that, I'm still working for these people, living in their van, drinking every day, and we got a larceny charge in that van. Now, we found out real quick you can't outrun the Mecklenburg County cops at 3 o'clock in the morning in a Cablevision van. They'll get you, you know. It just kept getting worse and worse, so I quit that job, and I went to the bars, you know. And I remember in these bars, I'd go in, and I'd set up a couple guys with some beers, and I'd say, let's get a half a gallon of liquor and go to your house. And I'd get in your house, and I'd stay as long as I could. And it might be 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months. And I'd always get run off, and I'd go to the bar, and I'd hit somebody else up, you know. And I did that for a while. I was in a bar one night, and this girl came in and said, "Aren't you Bobby's brother?" And I said, "Yeah." And I hadn't seen my brother in about 5 years, and she took me over into North Charlotte, and we pulled in the driveway, and there's 30 Harley-Davidson motorcycles in the yard. Went in the house, and them bikers had guns strapped on them, and they drinking liquor out of the bottle, and I felt comfortable, you know. And I was needing a place to stay, so I just stayed there. And come to find out, my brother was the president of the club, you know, and I felt like I'd arrived in. And, but I stayed drunk at that place, you know, went to work with a couple of them guys doing brick work. And I remember I was mixing mortar and hauling brick for them guys. And we drank every day, you know, and it was, I remember one night we came home and I think it was me and Toad and Snake was sitting there drinking a half gallon of Jim Beam. And I remember down the hallway, the bathroom door opened, out stepped this beautiful Mi'kmaq Indian. She had hair down to her belt. I had hair down to my belt. And she got more tattoos than I got, and that impressed me, you know. But I remember I passed out that night. When I came to, I was looking for the Indian, and she was gone. And about a month after that, I was in this bar, and that Indian came in the bar with this young guy, and she came straight to me and said, "Mike, I'm taking you home with me tonight." And I said, "Well, let's go," you know. And she took me to this. She lived in a trailer park, and the smallest trailer in this place. I remember the blocks in the back of the trailer was sinking in the mud. When you went in the front door drunk, you went straight to the back wall, you know. And we slid down the wall to the bedroom. She had the bed leveled off, and we had a fifth of Jim Beam, started drinking on that. And I remember the wind was blowing so hard, I thought it was going to blow the trailer over, you know. And, well, we came to the next day and went outside of that trailer, and there was pine trees laying through trailers. And we didn't know what happened. Well, come to find out, Hurricane Hugo hit that night. It tore that place up, you know. And I was there with a woman of my dreams, so I just never left, you know. We became best drinking buddies. The next thing you know, we're getting married in a beer joint down in Charleston, South Carolina. Her sister married us. People used to say, "Y'all ain't really married." And I knew we were because I had to pay for the divorce. But we stayed drunk. And both of us in and out of jails, you know. And I remember last time I got arrested, I was standing in a courtroom in front of a judge. And I knew I was guilty, you know, and I went up there prepared to go to prison that day. And all the guys I grew up with been in and out of prison their whole life, and I just thought it was my turn, you know. And I remember I stood in front of that judge, and what I heard him say was, 2 years in prison or AA? Well, you ain't got to be a genius to figure out the better deal. I don't know what AA is, but I know it ain't prison. I'll take the AA. And he gave me a 2-year sentence suspended with 2 years supervised probation, sent me to AA, sent me to a treatment center to take an assessment, sent me down the hall to meet my probation officer, met the meanest woman I ever met in my life. She said, "Mike, when you have an appointment to see me, if you're late, I'm going to lock you up." I'd go early, and she'd cuss me out for coming too early. But I just did everything that woman said do, you know. And at that time in my life, man, I was like walking the streets, man. I was homeless, and I didn't know what to do. And my mama always told me I could come back home if I needed to, and I needed to, you know. I never would before, but I always said I was too proud. But I know I didn't want my family to see me in the condition I was in. And so I was back at my mama's house, and I started going, you know. I went over to this treatment center to take an assessment, and I didn't know what that was. And they had a lot of questions I answered, and I guess I got one wrong, and they told me I was an alcoholic. They said, "You need to come to treatment." I said, "No, I need to go to work." And so they gave me outpatient treatment for 18 and a half weeks. And I remember going to this treatment center, and I hated every bit of it, you know. And at that time in my life, I didn't want to drink no more, but I didn't want to have to do all this stuff that I was having to do. And but I remember, thank God, it was a treatment center that took us to Alcoholics Anonymous. They took us, the first week I went over there, they took us to a closed speaker meeting at the Hawthorne Group in Charlotte. And I remember walking in that AA meeting, and the first two people I see is my junior high school principal sitting beside my Sunday school teacher, you know. And I'm kind of worried about that Sunday school teacher. His daughter's the one who lived in that van with me, you know, and I was worried about him a little bit. But I remember looking at all the cleaned up, shiny people in AA, and I thought, I'm not like these people, you know. And I hated going to the meetings. And I'd just sit back in the back, somebody come up and ask me to do something. I'm like, nah, it's okay, you know. And somebody come up and say, "Hey, will you read this?" I'm like, nah, I can't read. Go away. And, you know, and that's the way I was. And I'd hear people in AA, and Well, me and my wife had split up, and we got back together, and I remember we both got new jobs, and she was working at night, and I was working in the daytime, and when we would meet in late in the afternoon, man, all we did was just argue with each other, man, and we found out real quick when we don't drink, we don't like each other, you know, and she would go to work, and I'd sit there by myself all cleaned up, and I'm like, what do you do when you don't drink? And I couldn't answer that question. And so I just go to an AA meeting because I knew I wouldn't drink there, you know. And I did that. And I remember I'd hear people say, all you have to do is just don't drink and go to meetings. And that's all I did for 8 months. And after 8 months of doing that, things did get a little better. Me and my wife was back together. I got my driver's license back, bought me an old van to drive. We got us an apartment. Both of us got new jobs. Started buying furniture out of the store instead of getting off side of the road somewhere. It was looking good, you know. And after 8 months of not drinking, I was at work one day, and I thought, you ain't had a drink in 8 months. You can drink a couple beers. Well, I went home, and she told me if I drank again, we'd split up. So I started an argument and packed my clothes up and left. Went over to the old Charlotte Coliseum Motel, got me a 12-pack of Bud, and locked the door, you know. I drank 3 or 4 of them beers, and nothing happened. Drank 3 or 4 more of them. Well, I don't know about y'all, but when I get a buzz, there's always something better happening across town. And I took off across Charlotte and went into a ballroom, started drinking double shots of tequila, and I don't remember leaving the bar. I came to the next day on the bathroom floor of that hotel room, sick as I ever been. I remember I climbed up on the sink and looked in the mirror, and I hated that guy looking back at me, man. I didn't want to be like that. I used to say, I don't know why I came back to AA that night. My old sponsor, Buck, told me, he said, Mike, you go to AA for 8 months. AA put a booger on you. And if you're here tonight, if you're planning on drinking again, you've been boogered up. It ain't no fun no more. Just stay here with us, you know. And, but that was September the 17th of 1992. And, me and my wife had, she got drunk that weekend and stayed drunk for a couple weeks. And I stayed in my van. And she called me at work one day, 2 weeks later, and wanted me to come back home. And I went back one more time. And for the next 11 months, you know, she quit drinking on her own, never went back to AA meetings. And I was going to meetings, but I didn't get a sponsor, and I wasn't working no steps, and I was miserable. And I remember 11 months like that. I was sitting in a meeting, probably 70 or 80 people in that meeting, and I felt like I was all by myself. And I couldn't imagine living the rest of my life drinking or not drinking. You know, the big book calls that the jumping off place, man. That's where I was at. And like in How It Works talks about, we stood at the turning point. I really believe that's where I was at. And I knew I was going to have to ask another man to help me if I was going to stay sober. And my wife told me she was drinking again, so I packed my clothes up and left for good this time. And slept in my van, went to a lot of AA meetings, you know. And I remember I was going to a group called Late Night East Side. They met on Friday and Saturday night at 10 o'clock. Probably 80 people in that meeting every Friday and Saturday night. A lot of young people, anywhere from 20 to 30 years old. And I'm going to tell you, what's that saying? That was one of the pockets of enthusiasm, man, in Charlotte, North Carolina. Them people took meetings all over Charlotte. They took it out to the Camp Green, out to the prison. They took it to treatment centers, to detox, wherever they could take a meeting, they took it. And I remember standing outside of that meeting with them guys, and they'd say, Mike, if you go where we go and do what we do, you don't ever have to drink again. And they'd say, even better than that, you don't ever have to be alone again. And they hooked me, you know. I got in that group, and I remember I got a sponsor in that group, and I asked this guy to be my sponsor. He said, Mike, are you willing to go to any length to stay sober? Now, he didn't tell me what that looked like, but I said, yeah. And he said, well, you give away freely what was so freely given to you. And I didn't know what y'all were going to give me, but I said, yeah. And he said, where do you live at? And I said, in that blue van sitting over there. He said, well, you can stay with me till you get you a place. 2.5 weeks later, I moved in next door to that guy. We went to meetings every day, man, every night. And, you know, he started sharing his life with me, you know. I didn't know what he was doing, but he was telling me all these things that I wouldn't have told nobody, you know. And, but I started feeling comfortable about telling him some of my stuff, you know. But I remember he said, Mike, do you have a home group? I said, no, I don't know what that is. And he told me what a home group was. And I said, well, I'll join your home group. And that was that late night east side. And I remember he told me, go over there early on Friday night. They're having a group contest meeting. Well, I didn't know what that was. I just showed up early. And I remember going in there, and they didn't ask me if I wanted to do anything. They told me, said, Mike, you're going to make coffee on Friday night and chair the meeting on Saturday night. And I just said, show me how, you know. And they showed me how, man. I'm going to tell you, that's really when I felt like I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, man, when I started doing something for somebody else, you know. And but that first sponsor, he had me reading the book, and I couldn't read too good. And I remember telling him I can't read that good. He started reading the book to me and sharing his experience with me, you know. And I'm grateful for that because I was having a tough time with that. But I remember he said, Mike, we're going to work these 12 steps. When the book says do something, we're going to do it together. And he showed me how to work these steps as it's outlined in the big book, you know. And he said, you don't have to understand what we're doing. If you just take the actions that it takes, and he said, I'll show you how to take the action, you won't drink again. And I said, okay. I trusted what he said, you know, and he started reading the book to me. I remember he started reading the doctor's opinion, you know, that once an alcoholic puts any alcohol in his system, it sets off a phenomenon of craving, which don't happen to normal people. He shared some of his experience, and I could identify with him, you know. Over on page 30, he was reading in there that we had to concede to our innermost self that we're alcoholic. He said, you can't have any kind of reservations that somehow, someday, you'll be able to drink like you see other people drink. He said, those thoughts have to be smashed. And he shared some of his experience, and I could identify, you know. He started talking to me about God. He said, Mike, do you believe in God? I said, well, I've always believed in something, but I've never had faith in it. I've never had any conception of it. You know, I had to believe in something in the home I grew up in. And he said, well, that's good. You know, he said, that's a good start. He said, so he started reading the book to me, man. He read in there that thousands of men and women, worldly indeed, flatly declared that since they came to believe in a power greater than themselves, took a certain attitude toward that power and did a few simple things, they had a revolutionary change in the way of their living and thinking. You know, he said, Mike, you got to take a certain attitude toward that power, you know. And he shared some of his experience on what he does, you know, you know, he went on to read some more and more about alcoholism. You know, there's about four or five great examples of the insanity of alcoholism. He said, Mike, when you was at work that day and your mind told you you hadn't had a drink in 8 months, you can drink a couple beers. He said, that's the insanity of alcoholism. It centers in your mind. You know, I didn't have a clue about that. He shared some of his experience about the insanity of alcoholism in his life, you know, and I could identify with all of it. You know, he went on to page 60, he said, being convinced. I said, being convinced of what? That you're powerless and that you need power. You know, we're going to move on to step three. And what he did was he started reading out of the big book to me, you know. He started reading that selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. So alcohol is not the root of the problem. Selfishness and self-centeredness is. You know, he went on to read in there that, you know, there's been times in our past where we made decisions based on self that places us in a position to be hurt. You know, and he went on to read that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. You know, I didn't know anything about self-will or God's will when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, but when he started reading in the chapter to the agnostics to me, you know, he started reading about where it talks about our childhood faith and in there it says, some of us only thought we neatly evaded or entirely ignored God. And, man, when I was 12 years old, when I started drinking, I started evading going to church with my family, started evading, you know, all that stuff. And by the time I was 15, I drank every day, man. I entirely ignored God. And I started making decisions based on self that would always place me in a position to be hurt. My whole life, I was self-will run riot, you know. So I could identify with everything he was reading to me and sharing with me, you know. I remember we got on our knees and we prayed that third step prayer. And we got off our knees, you know. He said, Mike, I want you to get on your knees and read it right out of the book every morning. And that's what I started doing. I remember asking him, I said, what's God's will for me? He said, Mike, when you make a decision to do something, do the opposite because you make bad decisions, you know. And I said, all right, whatever, you know. But I just started taking those actions, man, and he got me right into a four-step inventory that first time we got in the book together. And he showed me how the columns are, you know, how them they're outlined in the book. And he had his with him, and he started showing me how he did his and how it is in the book. And I'll tell you, you know, even though I took these steps and, you know, all the way up through 11, even though I didn't have any kind of bright light spiritual experience, I didn't have any kind of overwhelming feeling that, you know, that I was changing or anything like that, you know, and I look back over my life in sobriety and I see how necessary those steps 4 through 9 is, you know. Step 4 for me was, it was all about all that stuff I've been stuffing inside me my whole life, all that fear and that hate and that resentment, all those deep dark secrets and all that stuff that I can't let you know about me. I've been stuffing my whole life, and that's what's been blocking me from God, you know. That's why I never had a relationship with God. And so as a result of working that fourth and fifth step, I was able to get all that stuff out. And as a result of getting it out, I got to learn about what my character defects and shortcomings were. And as a result of that, man, I was able to see on my eight-step list that I had to write. You know, and I was able to go back and clean up the wreckage of my past, you know. So all that stuff unblocked me from the power, you know. And that's exactly what it was meant to do. And so I remember when I was about a year and a half sober, I had me a nice apartment. And I guess I was 3 years sober. I came home one night and I went to bed, and sometime during the night I rolled over and my arm went underwater. Now you can imagine what I thought, and I thought, well, I don't do that no more. I quit drinking. Well, the water was waist deep, and I was in shock, you know. It was Sunday morning at daybreak, and I remember I started hearing people waking up in that. Man, it had rained so hard, so fast, it flooded out 280 apartments, and I could hear people crying and screaming, you know. And I remember I walked out my back door, and I stepped out, and it came up to my chest, and I couldn't get on my knees that morning. And I remember I just looked up, and I said, God, help me. My next thought was, and I really believe this is that God consciousness that it talks about in the Appendix 2. My next thought was, help people get out. I really believe that was that God consciousness. I started helping my neighbors get out, and finally the rescue people made me get out. My first sponsor in AA showed up and with dry clothes and hot coffee, and they stayed with me till 1:30 that afternoon. We went back into that apartment, and I'd lost everything. It was all trash. I had all these beautiful antiques I was collecting, man, and it was all trashed. And I was proud of that stuff because I've never owned anything my whole life, you know. I remember going back into my bedroom with my first sponsor and a friend of mine, and I remember he grabbed me and hugged me and said, Mike, cry if you need to, and he cried with me. I was proud of that stuff. He told me something I thought was pretty crazy. He said, Mike, maybe God wants you to have better stuff. I was like, man, that's easy for you to say. You didn't lose everything, you know. But he took me back into his home again, and for the next month, AA took care of me. They took me to meetings. They took me to work. They picked me up from work, you know. I go to a meeting, somebody come up and shake my hand. They turn around and walk away and leave a $20 bill in my hand, you know. And but I stayed with my first sponsor for a month and got me another place, you know. And what happened was the Small Business Administration gave out disaster loans, and they said, go down there and fill out the paperwork. And I'm like, you know, there ain't nobody going to loan me no money, you know. My credit wasn't bad. I just never had credit, you know. But I went down there and did the paperwork, and back in 95, the government shut down. And the day before they shut down, the check was in the mail. You know, they replaced everything I lost, better stuff, you know, just like that first sponsor said. And so 2 years later, I told them boys that moved in there to get flood insurance, and none of them did. And 2 years later, those apartments flooded out again. And I remember I got home from work, and I had a message to call this guy, and I called him. And he was getting ready to walk into his apartment right after the water went down. And he walked in, and he said, oh, my God, Mike, I've lost everything. I knew exactly how that guy felt. I was able to share my experience with that guy, all the people who helped, not just AA, but, you know, they'll probably give out disaster loans, you know, or whatever. I was able to tell him something he probably thought was pretty crazy. Maybe God wants you to have better stuff too, man. I don't know, you know. And but that taught me a big lesson. 2 years later, it don't matter what happens to me in sobriety. You know, it don't matter what happens. There's always going to be somebody put in my path that I'm going to be able to share my experience with that person, where maybe they don't have to take a drink that day or ever, you know. And so, you know, I kept learning lessons, working these steps and trying to practice them in my life a day at a time. And, you know, I remember back, I was about a year sober. I started going to a lot of conventions, you know, and started meeting a lot of people. And that's where I met my second sponsor, Buck. He was doing the recording at these places. And I remember walking up to him and I said, "Hey, can I help you load that stuff up?" He didn't even think about it. He said, "Yeah, I'm parked out in that red van out front." And I took all his equipment outside and loaded it up in his car. I came back and he had a big old grin from ear to ear. And I didn't know why he was so happy to see me come back, but he said, he gave me a chip at my 3-year anniversary, and he told that story. And he said, when that guy took off out the door with all my stuff, I thought, what did I do? He's going to steal all my stuff, you know. And I knew that big grin he had, he was glad to see me come back, you know. But it was like an instant trust. He said, "Hey, will you go to Raleigh with me next week?" I said, "Yeah." And we went to record a North Carolina State Convention. You know, he said, "Hey, man, will you go up to Virginia with me?" I said, "Yeah, I'll go to Virginia with you." Went to record the Oceanfront Conference up in Virginia Beach, you know. And I just went everywhere he went for the next 8.5, 9 years. And him and his wife, they both died the same year. It's been about 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years. And they'd have over 50 years in AA and Al-Anon, man. And they introduced me to people from all over this country, man. It's just unbelievable. And, but he took me back through the steps, and my life just kept getting better, you know. I went back and started cleaning up the wreckage of my past, and I had a lot of family I didn't know where they were. A lot of them's names changed. I had cleaned up, bought me a suit, and I went back into the church I grew up in, and I found family, you know. And I remember one of my cousins invited me over to her mama's house for dinner about a week later, and I went over there, and they put together a family reunion. All these family members I hadn't seen in 20 years, new family members I didn't even know I had. You know, and I would have missed that had I not been trying to make my amends, you know. And but they gave me a lot of gifts, man, just family treasures that I never would have seen had I not done that. And I'm so grateful for that. But, you know, I remember going up to my mom's house, and me and my family's never been close, man. And but I remember going up to my mom's, and it was around November, and I walked in the house I grew up in. She lived by herself, and it was freezing cold. You could see her breath. It was so cold. And I remember walking through her living room, and all her antique furniture was gone. And we went into her bedroom. She had this little tiny heater trying to stay warm. And I asked my mom, you know, what's wrong? And she had lost her job that April and didn't tell nobody. She was selling her furniture to pay her bills, and they cut her heat off. And that tore me up to see her living like that, you know. My mom was a nurse. You know, she was a long time nurse, and but she had lost her job and didn't tell nobody. And I remember going home that night, and I thought I'd be selfish if I didn't go up there and help her. I really believe maybe it's God's way of putting me and her in each other's life, where maybe we can form some kind of relationship we've never had. That's what I like to think. And I remember I went back up there and asked her if I could come home, and she said, "I wish you would," you know. And I was able to take all that better stuff up there and share it with my mom. And I remember getting up there, you know, and it was tough, man. You know, I couldn't talk to her hardly, you know. And, I'd go to my home group, and I'd say, "Why can't I come in here and hug any one of you and tell you I love you? And I can't even do that with my own mama." And they'd say, "All you got to do is just do it." It wasn't that easy. But I remember she come down the hall one night, and I grabbed her and hugged her and told her I loved her. First time I can ever remember doing that. And she said, "I love you too, Mike." And it got easier. I started doing it more often. I started talking to my mom. I'd get home from work, and I'd sit down with her and talk with her. I learned a lot about her I didn't know about. She's had a rough life, you know. And but I remember my mom telling me about family, and she was telling me about my dad. And she said, "Mike, your dad lived on the streets of Charlotte when he was 15 years old. He'd been locked up 100 times public drunk. He went to prison for armed robbery." And then she looked me right in the eye, and she said, "You were just like him." And when she said that resentment I had washed away, man. I totally forgave my dad that day. And what I realized was he was a sick man. I don't know if he was an alcoholic or not, but he was a heavy drinker. I know that. And I know today, if I'd have had one kid when I lived out there the way I lived drinking, there's no way I could have took care of that kid. And I really believe my dad gave us a break, you know, by leaving. And I was able to write him a letter. I kind of finally found out where he was. He was out in Grants Pass, Oregon, and I was able to send him the letter. I didn't expect to have no relationship or anything. I just wanted to let him know I didn't hate him, you know. And he called me on the phone, and we talked, you know, and it was a good talk. We didn't talk about our past. We talked about what we were doing today. And I'm so grateful I was able to do that, man, because it wasn't a month after that he died of cancer. And so, you know, I'm so grateful that I was able to do that. But I remember going, you know, my mom, being a retired nurse, she wasn't feeling good, and she done diagnosed herself, and it was the wrong diagnosis, and she was having a hard time breathing, and we were supposed to go out to Blackstone, Virginia, and I told Buck I can't go this weekend. My mama's sick. And I remember he said, you need to take care of her. So I stayed home, and that Thursday morning I took her up to the hospital, and they put her in a room, and I stayed with my mom that day till 7 o'clock that evening. And I remember my mama said, Mike, there's nothing you can do here. You need to be with those AA people up in Virginia. I said, are you sure? And she said, yeah. She loved you AA people. She didn't know who you were, but she knew y'all saved her boy's life. And I went up to Blackstone. When I got back, I called her doctor, and her doctor said, Mike, your mama has terminal lung cancer, and she ain't going to live long. I said, well, how long's that? And he said, maybe 3 months. And I was able to bring my mama home and take care of her, you know. My mom quit her job and took care of both of her parents, the parents who adopted her when she was 2 years old. And she lived on their Social Security and took care of both of them in that home. And they both died at home, you know. And I wanted her to die there too, you know. And man, I'm telling you, that was one of the hardest things I ever did. And I remember late at night, she'd climb in my bed and she'd put her hand on my shoulder and she'd be crying. And I didn't know what to say to her. I know today I didn't have to know. I was just there with her, and I'd grab her, and I'd hold her in my arms through her sickness. I was thinking about all the damage I've done to her and my family, and, you know, and I remember going on these railroad tracks one night about 15, 16 years old, with a pint of Everclear and some long-neck Budweisers. I don't remember coming off those railroad tracks, but I remember coming to the next day, laying on the living room floor of that house, and my mama knew about alcoholism. And my mama was laying in that floor holding me in her arms through my sickness. And when I got up off the floor, I looked around the house, and in a rage, I broke and busted up anything you could break or bust up. And I don't remember doing that. I never thought my alcoholism affected anybody. I know today it affected everybody I come in contact with somehow. So, man, thank God that y'all taught me about being responsible, and I was there with her when she climbed my bed, and I was able to hold her in my arms through her sickness. Finally, hospice came in, and my mom, being a good mom, you know, I was single, and my mama was trying to hook me up with a head hospice nurse, you know. I didn't have the heart to tell her she was gay. It probably wouldn't work out. But me and that nurse would just sit and smile at each other, act like my mom was setting us up, you know. But I was able to be there for my mom when she took her last breath, man. What an honor that is, you know. My mama gave me, she gave me my childhood home, you know, and there's people in this room that know my wife, Kathy. She just celebrated 20 years in April, and she's, we love Alcoholics Anonymous, man. When we were dating, we had a dream of building a log cabin on top of a mountain. And that dream came true down near Brevard, North Carolina, a place called Penrose. We built a log cabin up on top of this mountain, man, and as far as you can see, it's just rolling hills, just beautiful. And we shared that home with hundreds of AA people and their families. You know, we'd have campouts and pig pickings, and we even got the chaplain down at the jail to come up and marry his couples up on the deck, you know. We just turned it on up there. But I remember... we lived up there for 3 years, and we found out we can still make bad decisions. We couldn't afford to live there, you know. And we struggled, and we'd get knocked down, and we'd be in debt, and we'd get back up about even, and we'd go back down again, and we finally just surrendered the house, you know. And we come off of that mountain, and people in AA would say, man, we're sorry you lost your house. I'm like, we didn't lose it. It's still up on that mountain. We don't live in it no more, you know. And we just moved on to a new dream, you know. And now's the dream. Now's this the dreams come true. We were able to buy a house up here in Virginia, up above Fancy Gap, but still in the mountains. I tell you, it's a lot easier to get home now. You know, we don't live on top of a mountain, but it's just absolutely beautiful. And but coming off that mountain, you know, I was 15 years sober, and I still have new awakenings. You know, there's a reading, and as Bill sees it on page 8, it's called A New Life, and that's where we got our home group name from. If you get a chance, read it, and it talks about the awakening must continue. And if we continue working these steps a day at a time in our life, we'll have new awakenings, you know. And at 15 years without a drink, 15 years sober in AA, coming off of that mountain, I had a new awakening. And what it was, if I've got to struggle to get something that I really want, or if I get something I really want and have to struggle to keep it, maybe at that time in my life, it ain't God's will I have it in my life and just move on to the next thing, you know. And I'll tell you, when you live like that, life is so much easier for us, you know. And but I'm so grateful, man. I try to practice these steps in my life a day at a time. And as a result of that, I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And there's no doubt in my mind God is working in my life. No doubt in my mind. And so as a result of that, man, you know, I was taught that you have a huge responsibility. And I'd say, well, what is that? And they said, to pass this thing on the same way it was passed on to you. You know, and so that's my primary purpose today, is to try to reach the new suffering alcoholic. When a man comes in our meeting, I want him to feel like he is welcome there, you know. Get over there and shake his hand and tell him what we do and what we don't do, and get him a cup of coffee and make him feel welcome. You know, that's what I was taught to do. And I tell you, man, there's nothing better. There's nothing better than that. To be able to, when a man comes up and looks you in the eyes, or tries to look you in the eyes and can't look at you, and you know he's hurting and he's suffering, and he says, Mike, will you show me how to live without drinking? What an honor that is. What an honor this guy's going to give his life to me to try to share a little bit of my experience with him, where maybe he can quit suffering. Or maybe he can get a life, you know. Man, I'm so grateful to this program. I heard a story about this man who lived down on the beach, and every morning he'd get up and he'd walk. And this one morning he was walking, he saw way off in the distance somebody was picking something up and throwing it in the ocean. When he got down closer, he saw where thousands of starfish washed up on the beach. When he got down to the man, he said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm throwing these starfish back in the ocean. And the man says, what difference can you make? There's thousands of them. There's thousands. And he reached down and he picked one more up and said, it makes all the difference in the world to this one. And he threw him back in the ocean, gave him his life back. I can identify with that story. The way our book talks about, the way we roar through people's lives like a tornado. I know my alcoholism affected everybody I come in contact with somehow. And I really believe that wind stopped blowing that morning I ended up in front of that judge. I know today that the judge knew more about me than I knew about myself. The judge was sober over 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And out of the thousands of drunks that went through his courtroom, I was the one he picked up and threw in the rooms of AA. And just a little bit of willingness to ask another man to help me and to try to work those steps to the best of my ability a day at a time. There's no doubt in my mind this program saved my life. And if you're new here and if you're wondering, is this for me? Just stay with us for a while. Just come to the meetings and just watch the people in there. Watch the guys who are, and the men and the women who are doing the work in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are the happiest members of Alcoholics Anonymous, the ones doing the work. Go up and ask one of them, say, hey, man, have you ever worked the steps with a sponsor out of that book? And if they say no, run from them. But if they say yes, say, will you show me how? And I'll guarantee you, man, if you just give it half of what you gave your drinking, it'll absolutely save your life too, man. Thank y'all for being here tonight, and thank y'all for listening.